This is a true crime in real-time roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crimes reported on by Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. In this episode, we're focusing on two high-profile cases, the Carmelo Anthony trial in Texas and the Vance Belter trial in Minnesota. Belter pleaded guilty this week to multiple charges related to stalking and killing Minnesota House of Representatives Speaker Emeritus Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark Hortman, as well as the stalking and shooting of Minnesota State Senator John Hoffman and his wife, Yvette Hoffman. You might remember Belter as the assassin who impersonated a police officer to stalk his victims. We'll hear reactions to the Belter case and Belter's plea deal, reported by Odyssey station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities. First, we're unpacking the trial of Carmelo Anthony, which concluded this week. Anthony, a 19-year-old who is accused of stabbing 17-year-old Austin Metcalf to death at a Frisco track meet last year, was found guilty of murder this week, and his attorneys have already filed an intent to appeal. Anthony's family told CBS News that they were, quote, delusional to think that the trial would result in a fair outcome, and they've claimed that witnesses lied on the stand. While the trial proceedings were mostly closed to the media, we'll get an inside look into what was going on in and outside of the Collin County Courthouse as the jury reached its decision. This reporting comes out of Odyssey station KRLD 1080 in Dallas. We'll actually start our dive into the Anthony case with reporting from Tuesday morning, before the verdict was delivered. Anthony's legal team announced the day before that the defense was resting its case.
And that was apparently a real surprise from people that are watching this. Even the jury kind of gasped when he said the defense rests.
It was a surprise to us.
Yeah, they really didn't do a lot of witnesses. I think they called 7 in total or 6.
Yeah.
And Carmelo Anthony didn't take the stand.
He did not.
The first voice you heard there belongs to Austin York. And the second was Mike Rogers. They host the Mid-Morning Mic Check on KRLD. Russell Scott, another KRLD reporter, joined them from the Collin County Courthouse in McKinney, Texas.
I'm getting the sense out there that a lot of people watching this from the legal standpoint are just kind of confused with what the defense was trying to do. At one point, even suggesting that Metcalf may have impaled himself.
Yeah, there were some back and forth outside of the courtroom about that, whether that could have happened or something like that. It's normally because the defense was saying this was self-defense. Normally in a self-defense case, you'll have the defendant take the stand in his own defense to talk about that. They didn't do that, which surprised a lot of people. And that's when people started suggesting that maybe they were looking at a manslaughter or maybe criminally negligent homicide.
Now, they didn't put Carmelo Anthony himself on the stand. Who did the defense put on the stand yesterday, Russell?
They called a couple of students. They called a coach who was at school with him. And that's all that they've called. That's pretty much it. And the students were there. I think there were 3 students were called to testify that the track culture is kind of a social event where students go back and forth between team tents and will often go to other teams' tents just to visit and kind of make it a social event. Now, you might remember the prosecution, when they called some students, they said, no, that's not the case. So you've got both sides presenting different witnesses and what their thoughts are on the social situation at a track meet.
It's one of those, though, if you're saying, hey, I was scared for my life, why not hear from him? He's the only one that could tell you what he was feeling.
Because cross-examination.
Yeah, we know that. There is a risk.
That's why.
Now, for some context about how the trial was going leading up to the verdict on Tuesday, we're going to listen in on a KRLD report from Friday, June 5th. While some trials are recorded and televised, like the O.J. Simpson trial in the 1990s, the Anthony trial was kept very private.
And
were you let back in, Russell?
It's quite a big issue.
I was let back into the courthouse this morning. They didn't allow me to go back in.
They didn't have big posters of your face up there and saying, don't let this guy in.
No wanted posters, at least none that I saw.
Okay, good.
And no pictures. Don't take any pictures. All right.
I walked in, had my phone in my pocket, and I did not take it out. Walked with my hands open so they could see I had nothing taking.
Hands in the air.
Hands in the air.
All right, Russell, what's going on today? We've got, I know that a lot of the testimony after yesterday was pretty difficult, and especially for some of the family members in there. What do we have going on today? Tell us.
Well, so far today we've had and again, let me just paint the picture. The prosecution presents their case first, and when they call a witness, the defense can cross-examine, but we're not going to hear the defense case till sometime next week. So prosecution continued calling witnesses today. They've called, so far today, a police officer who was working right next door to the track meet at another athletic complex. He was one of the first to arrive, and they also talked to a paramedic who arrived on scene as well this morning. They're also being cross-examined by the defense attorneys. Again, you know, I got out here at 5:30 this morning, and they were not allowing the public into the parking lot at the courthouse until 6, but there was a line of cars already lined up down the road, and when they opened the gate at 6 o'clock, that line of cars went in very quickly, and people lined up, even though the courthouse wasn't going to open until 7 a.m. They're trying to get a seat to watch what goes on in the courthouse. And really, other than that, you know, what I noticed in the courthouse itself, there's not a lot of people. There's not a lot, the normal everyday activity you would expect in a courtroom. And I think a lot of that is because there's so much security and so much attention on this case that people are putting off courthouse work that they might have to do, or going to get their driver's license or whatever, or car registration. Maybe they're putting that off, at least for right now. But again, we've got some supporters of Carmelo Anthony who are out in the parking lot. You've got a lot of sheriff's deputies who continue to patrol the parking lot. And again, we're gonna get information. Some of this is going to be kind of dull. But yesterday, as you mentioned, some of that was emotional. They listened to the 911 tape yesterday, and that was emotional. And both mothers are in the courtroom, and both of them were crying. And you know, on the 911 call, I'm told that you could hear Austin Metcalf's last gasp for breath, which is just horrible. Now, they've been watching some video as well. The camera is turned, or the screen that they're watching the video on is turned away from the gallery, so the gallery can't really see everything. But the judge this morning did tell the jury that nobody in the gallery is allowed to talk or make any noise or any facial expressions, and if they do, they're going to be asked to leave. NBC 5 says that 3 people this morning were asked to leave the courtroom because they weren't following the judge's protocol in that.
I can bet. So it's not just you that they're singling out there, Russell. It's everybody not following the rules.
And the judge has said he's just trying to protect the sanctity of the court and make sure that, you know, nothing happens that could lead to a mistrial or something of that nature. And he just wants to make sure it's a safe and secure location, which I totally understand. We also have heard from a couple of coaches who showed up on the scene.
That's right.
One of those coaches was a former Army medic and said he got there and he kind of testified as to how he found Austin Metcalf and him trying to administer CPR and try to save his life. And he talked about how he wasn't able to do that. So we're going to hear probably more of that as they continue to set the stage. They're trying to show it was murder and that Carmelo Anthony brought that knife and was trying to cause some kind of commotion. The defense, of course, says that's not the case. They're saying this is a kid who had ace grades, went to work 2 jobs while he was in school, and it was nothing more than self-defense.
One of the most controversial aspects of this trial was the jury itself. Anthony is black, and Metcalf was white. And the jury, it was entirely white. Here's a breakdown of how that happened.
It's an all-white jury, and we had speculated, well, you know, that might be grounds for an appeal if it doesn't go the defense's way. Well, maybe not. Dallas Morning News has been looking into this. Here's how it works. Either side obviously can ask to remove potential jurors, but the judge has to decide whether there's a legal reason to excuse them. And according to the Supreme Court, race is not a reason. You can't remove prospective jurors because of race. You can based on other things, like a prospective juror's occupation. And that was the case in this
trial. All teachers, weren't they?
Yeah. Three jurors, they were all black women, were struck by the prosecution. They said because of their job. They're teachers. So it's possible that prosecutors, they don't want any teachers on the jury because this case involves two high school students. The defense wasn't buying that, saying that race was, in fact, the reason. And so they asked for a ruling from the judge. But if you do that, you need to be able to bring receipts. You got to be able to prove that it was based on race. And Sandra Garrett Thompson is a law professor at the University of Houston Law Center who has studied jury selection, says that's a very hard thing to do. And apparently the judge in this case felt the defense didn't do it. So he allowed the prosecution to strike those three jurors from the pool, and that is how we've got an all-white jury in this case.
It's crazy that it came down to three teachers, because teachers, to me, I if I'm a prosecutor, I wouldn't want any teachers on that juror anyway. Doesn't matter, white, black. It's amazing that all three happen to be black, all three happen to be teachers. That's crazy.
Why wouldn't you?
Because you're thinking, okay, I can see my high school student. I would not. You have sympathy.
Yeah.
You're a teacher. My mother was a high school teacher, and she has had her fellow or former students go down bad roads, and she always had a heart for them. Oh, I remember they were so good, and I could see the good in them, and this and that and the other.
But as a teacher, you could potentially have sympathy for either one.
You would think, but in this situation, you would just say, hey, let's just strike them all together. It'd be like somebody saying, I don't know, you know, I've got a kid who's 17. Yeah, you could have sympathy for both, but most of those people that have a kid that's 17, they struck. So
probably
anyway,
Let's dive a bit deeper now into Anthony's defense with KRLD's coverage from Monday.
The defense called six witnesses, tried to convince the jury that Anthony was acting in self-defense when he fatally stabbed Austin Metcalf last year. They had witnesses tell the jury that it's not unusual for opposing teams to go to other schools' tents, as the prosecution had claimed. They claimed that Metcalf actually put his hands on Anthony, which caused him to react with the knife. The jury then went to lunch, which was supposed to end at 12:30, but when everyone came back to the courtroom, they were not let in. So for about an hour and a half more, everyone was kept out of the courtroom. Then they came in, and then came word the defense had rested its case. So right now we know that tomorrow morning we're going to hear closing arguments, and the jury is going to be sequestered after that.
And, of course, the question was, there was a lot of speculation when they were taking this lunch break, would they let Carmelo Anthony take the stand?
Yeah, I thought that, and that's what we kept hearing from everybody that was in that courtroom. I just can't imagine that, and none of us are lawyers in here. We did stay at Holiday Inn Expresses, but
right.
Other than that, that just seems like a bad idea. And
yeah.
So I'm not really surprised that Anthony didn't end up taking the stand.
Well, the thing about it, too, is that if he, remember, this is like a 17-year-old kid at the time that this happened. He's still just a teenager. And the prosecution very likely would have blown holes in
the
story.
Knife?
Right,
why
exactly.
Bring the knife? And that's the big question. I don't think that they ever really answered that in the defense, but we'll see.
It was a hot and sunny day in McKinney on Tuesday when people gathered at the courthouse following the surprise move by Anthony's legal team to rest their defense. Protesters gathered outside, some with signs supporting Anthony and others with signs supporting Metcalf. At one point, a KRLD reporter even captured a photo of a woman lying down in the heat as everyone waited for the verdict.
Emotions ran high outside the Collin County Courthouse all week, and today was no exception. KRLD's Chris Fox continues our team coverage.
Tensions began to rise outside of the Collin County Courthouse this morning, around the same time the jury began deliberating, just before 11 a.m.
This whole thing's been racist. We didn't make it racist.
Then the news came. The jury had decided that Anthony was guilty. Shortly after, he was sentenced.
Vocal standoffs between supporters of Carmelo Anthony and those seeking justice for Austin Metcalf. Anger from the Anthony supporters as word of the murder conviction began popping up on their phones. Defense attorney Sean Duretti has been following the trial.
You heard from 21 witnesses. To come back that quickly, I think for them it must have been a clear-cut case that state proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt in that he was guilty of intentional murder.
Outside, things got tense even before the verdict was announced. 35 years in prison for Carmelo Anthony. Under state law, now that Anthony has been sentenced, he's back in custody, now considered a convicted felon.
And here's an account of what was going on inside the courtroom.
Yeah, we were told that when the verdict was read, guilty of murder, that Carmelo Anthony broke down, cried, had to be helped back to his seat. His mother was an audible gasp in the courtroom from her. It was then on to the punishment phase, where she was the only one that was called to testify on behalf of her son. She asked the jury for mercy. She said that her son was truly sorry for what had happened. No opening statements were made. Then the judge and the lawyers went back and decided on what charges and the documents that jurors will use to decide the punishment. Now, that punishment can be 5 to 99 years. The jury will be allowed to consider sudden passion. That's a sentence of 2 to 20 years. Now, the prosecutor, Bill Wirsky, said whether you like it or not, mercy to the guilty is cruelty to the innocent. He did not give a certain time period or year sentence that he would like the jury to consider, but he did say reject this sudden passion argument that Carmelo Anthony is guilty of murder and therefore should be sentenced as such. And the defense says decisions in the heat of the moment are different from decisions after cool reflection. They also asked the jury to reflect the age consider the age, that is, of Carmelo Anthony. When this happened, he was 17. So the jury got the case again at 4:47.
And a lot of people, even you had said earlier today that Carmelo Anthony, it is possible, has spent his last night in his own home bed.
Yeah, we were thinking that today on the show, the Mid-Morning Mic Check, is it, you could think about that last moment of rest, freedom, thinking that you could be spending a large amount of your life in prison.
Because there's no bond now.
There is no bond. He goes directly into the Collin County Sheriff's custody, and that's where he is right now.
Back outside, reactions to the news continued, and KRLD was still on the scene.
I'm Emily Capatillo, and tensions became higher when people started shouting guilty or guilty of murder once the verdict was reached. Some people erupted into tears, arguments, disbelief, and even anger.
The reason why this case is so important is because America is terrified of black self-defense. They can't fathom it, you know? They think they need to have the ups on us every day. And, you know, if I say anything that McAfeeans disagree with, all of a sudden I'm a racist. And I'm like, wait a minute now.
Supporters for Anthony say the trial wasn't fair, while supporters for Austin Metcalf say he deserved justice in the case.
We've got a group of people who are now bending down to pray. They're in the middle of the parking lot. And that's kind of what's happening at the moment. I think right now what I would describe it is, for the Carmelo Anthony advocates, is shock. One woman down on the ground, she's crying. Several other people walking around. You can hear others that are crying as well.
It happened as quick as it did because justice delayed is justice denied, and I'm sure they're going to appeal it, but I'm happy with the decision.
All right.
That's one of the Austin Metcalf supporters, advocates. Not sure how to describe him, but again, crying on one side, on the other side, pleased with the verdict.
And at the KRLD studio in Dallas, around 35 miles from McKinney, the news team was also reacting to Anthony's verdict in real time.
Let's bring in our whole group here. We've got Eric Bushman. We've got David Rankin. We got Mike Rogers, my co-host at the Mid-Morning Mic Check. Guys, surprise, what are you thinking?
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting is right now we're going to go right into the punishment phase, and the range here for sentencing is anywhere from 5 to 99 years. The jury could still give Anthony a relatively, I don't know what the right word
light
is,
sentence.
Light sentence. Yeah. I should say that, because the minimum here is 5, and the maximum for the manslaughter charge, that I understand it, was 20. Mm-hmm. So there's still an option here for a light sentence. And, of course, we had talked about the same attorney, Toby Shook, got Amber Geiger a relatively light sentence when he represented her. So that may be a similar approach that the defense attorney is going to take now.
A lot of shock and kind of surprise, too, as well, is that how quickly this jury returned a verdict. They only got the case at about 11 o'clock this morning, and they turned right around. They had some kind of a verdict. We've been waiting for this verdict for almost an hour itself.
Yeah, I really, when they, it was a quick verdict, I figured that was going to probably happen because they knew that this guy was guilty of something.
Deliberations lasted, I think, maybe a little under 3 hours. When it's that quick, generally
it's
not good for the defendant.
Is there a feel from any of you on which way they go? I think if the feel from what I've seen reported,
that they'll probably go on the lighter side, as Russell has said. It's mm-hmm. somewhere maybe, and I say light, 15 years to me would be kind of light. I don't think maybe 20, but someone 15 to possibly 20.
Of course, the question is, you know, this guy is now an adult, 19 years old. He's been actually convicted of murder in Texas, and people are worried about, you know, his life being ruined. But then we take a look at the Metcalf family. They've lost a son, and what is going to be a jail sentence, a prison sentence, that's going to satisfy justice, as we heard from that one representative that Russell was talking about, justice denied. What is a doable sentence for a murder charge?
Eventually, Anthony was sentenced to 35 years in prison. One day after the conviction, his attorneys filed an intent to appeal. Defense attorneys Jeremy Rosenthal and Terry Bentley Hall, who don't work together and did not participate in the Carmelo Anthony trial, joined KRLD to discuss angles for the appeal. We'll start with Bentley Hall discussing the all-white jury angle.
And the appellate court will take a look at that and see if it was truly a race-neutral reason that those jurors, potential jurors, were excused.
Rosenthal says that's not an easy path.
The trial judge gets a lot of leeway with that call, so it would be difficult to overturn that on appeal, but you better believe that's going to be part of the appeal.
As for the criticism that there were no black jurors, Wersky says a quarter of the jurors were minorities, and that was a fair cross-section of the county.
And as for the prosecution,
District Attorney Greg Willis and lead attorney for the prosecution, Bill Wersky, say they are relieved following the murder conviction and 35-year sentence for Carmelo Anthony. Wersky says he's been involved in a lot of high-profile cases, but has never seen as much misinformation and intentional disinformation put out on social media platforms.
I've never seen the type and the intensity of that misinformation. And it seemed to draw a lot of people off sides. But what was gratifying for me is knowing one day we'd get into court where 12 citizens could hear the fact.
Willis says while they wanted the public to see the trial, they were concerned for the safety of those involved, and so they agreed to prohibit audio and video of the trial.
Everything has to be balanced. You know, word still got out. In a perfect world, everybody could have seen it live. But it's not a perfect world, and people had real concern about their safety.
And the fundraising platform GiveSendGo has now closed the fundraiser for Carmelo Anthony's family following his murder conviction. The family was asking for $1.4 million to help with legal expenses, relocation due to escalating threats, transportation, and basic living needs. The platform put out a statement online saying the fundraiser was created to support pretrial needs and funds were dispersed over the last year for lawful purposes. But again, that has now been closed.
For more on the case, News Nation's Xavier Walton joined KRLD the day after Anthony was convicted.
Now, Xavier, man, we were watching yesterday on TV. You were right out in the middle of it outside that courthouse yesterday when that verdict came down.
I was, and if you're watching, I was not alone. Dozens of people out there. I'll tell you what, I'm glad you guys said that. Yesterday was a whirlwind. And you know, obviously they had court on Saturday, but I don't think anybody really anticipated it. Some of the attorneys I'd been speaking to all along, they said, given, you know, how this trial had gone so far, they anticipated that maybe, you know, Monday both sides would rest their cases. But I mean, to think that we went through the sentencing phase where he had 35 years. I just stopping and thinking about it. It happened so quick. I don't know that a lot of people had time to digest what happened. But I could tell you, you know, on both sides of it, it was a lose-lose situation. I was out there next to people who were supporting Austin Metcalf's family and, you know, obviously Carmelo Anthony's family. And a lot of the people I spoke to said there was no win in this one.
I was just going to ask you, too, when you're in the middle of it, we were watching you on, in fact, actually took some of the News Nation coverage yesterday. How was the feeling there when the word started to creep out, because nothing was televised, obviously, everything had to be word of mouth, that he had been found guilty of murder?
You know, I would say shocked but not surprised. The people I was surrounded by who were there in support of Carmelo Anthony and his family, they kind of had this idea, like this in the back of their heads, that this was going to happen. based on, you know, what they've experienced in their lifetime. And this is, you know, from them, what I was getting from them being on the ground. So a lot of initially when the, you know, verdict was read and people started trickling out, the first thing that I kept hearing was about, you know, the jury. You know, not a single black person on the jury. So a lot of people were questioning whether or not he was even going to get a fair trial before the trial even started. And that was, you know, you start hearing people yelling all white jury, and, you know, there was a lot of anger. There's a lot of frustration. And then there was just an incredible amount of sadness. There was a lady, you know, who I'd been running into because she'd been out here pretty much every day documenting everything. And she fell to her knees. She started crying. And, you know, it was on live TV, and I just, you know, asked her a couple of questions. But, you know, there's so much raw emotion playing out from, you know, from even when jury selection started to then when you had a verdict being read. It was just so much emotion.
Have we heard from any of the jurors yet as to their thought process in coming up with the verdict and the sentence? They had a pretty wide range. It could have gone, I think, 5 to 99 years. Why 35? Has anyone spoken out about that?
Not yet, at least not that I've seen. And, you know, I've been watching a lot of the reading and watching a lot of the other news organizations, seeing who's got what. I haven't seen anything yet about that. But yeah, you know, obviously guilty of murder. They didn't go the manslaughter route. And so 5 to 99 years, they landed at 35, eligible for parole after 17 and a half. You know, that's, you know, if nothing else happens, he gets out good behavior. Ironically, 17 is how old both of the young men were. Austin Metcalf, no longer with us, 17 years old when he died. You know, reading some of those impact statements, wow, extremely powerful. You know, the mom saying, you know, you were sentenced to 35 years. I'm going to be, you know, doing a life sentence without my son. Yeah, you hear and see stuff like that, and you just think, man, both of these families were just absolutely ruined, crushed. I mean, I understand, you know, Carmelo Anthony is still alive, but, you know, he's going away for a long time.
I know that you hit on something, the victim impact statements. That's what I was going to get to. You obviously spoke about the mom, but the father and even Hunter Metcalf also did a victim impact statement, and they both asked that Carmelo Anthony looked them in the eye, and apparently he wasn't able to, or he didn't.
That's right. And yeah, I think and I actually have it in front of me here. You can't even look me in the eye right now, but you can stab my effing son in the heart. Was from Jeff Metcalf, the father of Austin's dad. You know, and just the amount of emotion, can you imagine? I know there was a portion during the trial where the family was asked to leave the court because of the graphic and just gruesome nature of what was being shown to jurors. That was, you know, some of the most gripping testimony when you're hearing from the medical examiner who did the autopsy, who performed the autopsy on Austin Metcalf. And the medical examiner testified that it was a gaping hole 2.5 inches in directly into Austin Metcalf's heart. So when you hear, or, you know, the impact statement from the dad, there's just so much anger, so much frustration. And you know what? Like, you can't tell somebody how to feel at the end of the day. And, you know, this dad and then this, you know, his brother, the twin who was literally there as his brother died, you know, he said, you took a son, a brother, a friend, my best friend from this world. You took someone away from me who was supposed to be an uncle to my kids. Now I want everything taken from you. You know, that's just, guys, it has been an emotional, as you've been following it, emotionally just dramatic. And at the end of the day now, I think what's happening next is there's going to be an appeal process from the Anthony side. But still, by no means is the Metcalf family waking up thinking we won. Because at the end of the day, Austin Metcalf is no longer here.
While Anthony's family has said they're planning for an appeal, Anthony has also reportedly said that he's now penniless and can't afford a lawyer. We'll be keeping an ear on this case, so check back for more updates.
Now we're headed to the U.S. District Court of Minnesota, where Vance Belter pleaded guilty to multiple charges Thursday related to stalking and killing Minnesota House of Representatives Speaker Emeritus Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark Hortman, as well as the stalking and shooting of Minnesota State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette Hoffman. Belter is a 58-year-old man who CNN described as a, quote, outspoken evangelical Christian. He also reportedly worked for a security company that advertised, quote, police-type vehicles. In his efforts to stalk and attack Democratic lawmakers, Belter reportedly impersonated a police officer. He was apprehended last year after a days-long manhunt. Reporter Mark Fry from WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities joined the station's Adam and Jordana show with Adam Carter and Jordana Green as news of Belter's guilty plea broke on Thursday, June 11th.
Mark, just take a second. Did Vance Belter have a chance to speak at all other than to just change his plea, or did his attorneys do that for him?
So he had a very interactive sort of back and forth dialogue with Judge Thunheim this morning as the judge read sort of the outline of the case. And then throughout the hearing today, Vance Belter's attorney read through the facts of the case and agreed to what those facts were in this case, Adam. And really, that was the extent of the speaking this morning, really, among anybody in there, was just sort of yes, no. The judge did ask Vance Belter how he was doing today. And again, Belter was very, very quiet in how he was talking, very soft-spoken, but still sounded very confident in how he was speaking, right from the get-go. And it was kind of interesting just to see the reaction the Hortman and Hoffman families were in the courtroom today as well. And one thing of note, Senator Hoffman, I think really the whole time was just leaned forward, just watching Vance Belter's almost every move. And that was something that really stood out to me this morning, Adam.
What did Vance Belter say to the judge? Did he address the case? Did he just give his plea? Did he address the families?
He has not addressed the family. So, Jordana, really what was happened today is Judge Thunheim brought in Vance Belter. Vance Belter sat down. They read the facts of the case to Vance Belter. He agreed if those were the facts of the case, including did he shoot and kill Mark and Melissa Hortman, to which he said yes. Did he stalk the Hortmans and other lawmakers? He answered yes. So it was really just outlining the facts of the case. There was really no full sentences spoken from Vance Belter this morning other than the initial how are you doing this morning, and he said I'm doing okay, thank you. And that was really just the extent, yes, no questions, and just agreeing to the facts of the case this morning.
Mark, I actually got chills when you said that Vance Belter said yes to the question if he killed Mark and Melissa Hortman. What was the Hoffman's family and what was the gallery's reaction to these acknowledgments?
Really, the biggest reaction, Jordana, that came this morning was during the facts of the case that were being read, and towards the very end when they were talking about when Vance Belter entered the Hortman's home and tried to flee, and sort of the final shot that rang out inside of that house on Melissa Hortman, and that probably drew the biggest reaction from the families here this morning, just an audible gasp. There was crying, and I think that was just what stood out to me, too, was just how focused they all were on Vance Belter. Sometimes in these cases, you see family members, they don't want to look at the perpetrator in this case, but that was not the case today. I mean, they were very much looking at him and listening to really every word that he was saying.
And you said Senator John Hoffman in the room. Was his daughter and wife there, too?
His daughter was not in the room today, from what I was told, but his wife was with him this morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
And also, we were hearing that nobody from the Belter family or any supportive friends were there. Is that also true?
That is true, yeah. No one from the Belter family or really anyone that looked as if they were supporting Vance Belter was in the courtroom today. So that also stood out. One thing as well, too, is just the amount of just family members, extended family members, it looked like, from the Hoffmans and the Hortmans that were there, too. That that really was sort of a signifying thing as well. But again, the bigger news today, too, the death penalty off the the case here. I mean, that was part of the big plea deal here today was he will not face the death penalty in two consecutive life terms with 40 years after that. That's going to be the recommended sentencing. Now, the judge can always sort of go off of that, but it sounds like that's going to be pretty consistent whenever that final sentencing date is set.
Good stuff, Mark.
We've heard a bit about Belter and his trial, so now let's take a moment to hear about his victims. We'll start with Melissa Hortman, formerly Melissa Halepsik. She was 55 years old. She was a Catholic who had served as a Sunday school teacher, and she lived in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. Hortman grew up in the state and moved to Boston to get her Bachelor of Arts degree from Boston University. She graduated magna cum laude in 1991. She also earned her master's degree from Harvard and a law degree from the University of Minnesota. In the 1990s, Hortman made headlines for winning a civil case involving discrimination by landlords. She was elected to the Minnesota House of Representatives in 2004 and eventually became the Minnesota Speaker of the House. And that's just a bit about her career. In her personal life, she married North Carolina native Mark Hortman, who also attended the University of Minnesota for graduate school. He'd been working as a program manager at the time of their deaths on June 14, 2025. According to an obituary in the Daily Tar Heel, Mark Hortman also volunteered with Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity for nearly 9 years. The couple shared two adult children. Thankfully, John and Yvette Hortman survived Belter's attack, but they were both hit by bullets when he shot into their home, disguised as a police officer. They faced surgeries and physical therapy in the months that followed. Hoffman was first elected to the Minnesota Senate in 2012, and he won multiple re-elections. His current term ends next year, and he's now running for re-election. Yvette previously worked in radio and then became a kindergarten teacher and advocate for children with disabilities, according to Radio Insights. The Hoffman's daughter, Hope, the person who called 911 when they were shot, has spina bifida. WCCO's Blois Olson and Vanita Sakar discussed the anniversary of the attacks this week, as well as developments in Belter's case.
How have people been handling this upcoming anniversary and also now this latest news in the political world?
You know, I think everybody's been preparing to reflect. Listeners should be reminded that I have a little closer seat to this. I advise the Hoffman family on personal matters related to this. I'm not a lawyer, but I handle media related to the incident. So I've had a little upfront look, and we've been preparing for kind of a peaceful, quiet week. In fact, denying all media requests. And then this news started to break last weekend, and it just turns people up. That's what I would tell you, that, you know, from last weekend to yesterday morning, the churn of, is this really happening? What do we know? How is it going to happen? And I think it keeps everybody on edge. And I would just remind us, this is my take, it's not the Hoffman's take, and it's, you know, is that, you know, we should reflect on the incidents of the year ago and not let today's news, while it is news and it should get covered, overshadow the lives of Mark and Melissa and the trauma of the Hoffman family as a whole, by letting, you know, the alleged shooter steal the headlines. Because I think everybody's kind of reflecting. The St. Paul City Council reflected yesterday. I myself am like, whoa, well, Thursday is going to be a different day in my mindset. And I think people close to them, but as a state, the best thing we can do is be civil, move forward, and remind ourselves that these folks, as public servants, became targets of horrific, horrific plot.
Oh, it's hard to believe just what torture it's been for those who knew the Hortmans well, loved them. You know, I just think about them these past year and leading up to this and these court cases and all of that. It just adds to the nightmare. I want to just review real quickly, what are all the different ways Melissa Hortman is being remembered and how to pay tribute to as far as anything concrete that's happening at the state?
We'll start with the basics. The Hortmans wanted people to plant trees. So if people planted trees and now the state will plant trees, there's Highway 610 will be named in the Mark and Melissa Hortman. There will be a garden at the state capitol. So I think those are the main ways. There's also a commission that's going to work on this memorial for the Hortmans through funding from this last state budget, supplemental budget. So I think there'll be many ways that they will be honored and remembered. There's also a movement to name the new state office building, or the remodeled state office building, the Hortman building. So I think, you know, there'll be constant reminders. I also just want to add that there's a certain surreal feeling about it being a year ago, because I just, that Saturday morning was so surreal, and now you start to relive it, and I think it's surreal still for many people.
I think you're absolutely right. When you look back on it, it just doesn't seem that it actually happened. How could something like that have happened? And certainly still people processing all of it.
Jason DeRussia of WCCO was joined by another local journalist to discuss the case this week.
All right, I want to get to Paul Bloom from Fox 9 because he was in the courtroom in federal court today when Vance Belter pled guilty to killing Melissa and Mark Hortman, shooting John and Yvette Hoffman, and showing up at two other state legislators' house with the intent of harming them as well. Paul Bloom with us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Paul, just reading the accounts of what happened and listening to our CCO radio reporters, it was emotional for me to hear it. What was it like in the courtroom today?
Yeah, chilling new details, you know, that we had not heard during, you know, Vance Belter's admission, during his allocution today. He's got to answer, you know, a steady dose of questions, you know, establishing that he is guilty of the crimes he's pleading to. And, you know, the most notable, and I'm sure you've heard it and sort of flagged it, is when he's at the Hortman house, you know, the horrifying details of assassinating, you know, the former DFL speaker of the house, inside her own home, you know, while she's fleeing up the stairs, you know, a very sort of deliberate planned out attack. He has this exchange with the husband at the door. Mark, you know, kind of makes, oh, Maple Grove police, there's been a shooting in the area. You know, who else is in the home with you? Oh, my wife. Oh, can you get her? I just want to make sure she's okay. Okay. You know, so he beckons, Mark beckons his wife. And that's when, you know, Belter opens fire and chases Melissa up the stairs and kills her. And that drew, you know, loud sobs and crying and gasps across the gallery. It was a jam-packed courtroom. The Hoffmans who were sitting front row, the Hortmans, you know, the parents, the adult children are in the courtroom. I mean, it was, yeah, that's a moment, a courtroom moment you don't forget.
Yeah. Yeah. And the families were so close, right? Like they were sitting right there, right near where Vance Belter was sort of telling his story.
Right, especially, you know, the Hoffmans, they took the front row. So John and Yvette, right, they're shot, what was it, I mean, more than a dozen times total. You know, John should be dead. I mean, there should be a couple more murder counts. And in reality, right, that was, you know, the intent. He also kind of detailed what he did there, which, you know, again, started out as police kind of following up on a reported shooting. And then all of a sudden, he says it's a robbery. He forces them downstairs, makes them put up their hands. And then he opens fire, of course, their grown daughter, Hope, nearby. So those details. But, yeah, the Hoffmans were right there. I got a good view of John. And he was sort of on the edge of his seat as Belter is allocuting and kind of, you know, nodding yes to kind of, you know, he's detailing what happened. Of course, you know, I don't know what John's memory is of those horrifying moments, but seemed to be sort of nodding in agreement, laser focused on what the defendant was saying. But, yeah, feet away. I mean, it's not –
you know, I know you've been in a lot of courtrooms. I mean, the federal courthouse is a little bit bigger. You know, there's a little bit of space, but no doubt. I mean, not far at all. And and it was just so cold, so just matter of fact. Just, you know, yes, I did it, guilty. Just
no emotion,
nothing. No, just on point. I mean, you know, I was just thinking, you know, he's now 58 or 57 when he carried out these attacks. You know, planned them for months. You know, no discernible criminal record of any kind. It just, you know, what we didn't get today, while we got these new details and a full admission, you know, he's planning it for months. Yes, he dressed up as police. Yes, he put on the silicone mask. He didn't say why, right? There was no component of motivation. Now, while Belter agrees to two life sentences plus 20 years on top of that, and it felt like in the court proceedings, you could probably just move on to sentencing today. Judge Thunheim will call back all the parties for a formal sentencing, and it is there where Belter will be formally given the opportunity to speak to the court. And perhaps there is where, you know, we kind of went in thinking, you know, will he rant at some point? During his admission, will we hear something from him? But, you know, like, I did it because, you know, so-and-so told me or whatever. We didn't get that at all today. So I think as we head towards the federal sentencing, I'll be curious to see what he does when given the opportunity to speak in court at a later date.
And it's always a double-edged sword, right, Paul? Because as much as I feel a little like, as a society, we want to understand that, there's also nothing stopping a killer from making up some nonsense and saying whatever they want and re-traumatizing the family again with whatever sort of craziness he wants to say.
No, you're exactly right. And some of the early reports on this case, you know, I don't know if you remember, he was spouting out to some reporters early on from the Sherburne County Jail that were his rantings and rants and, you know, in writing. And then clearly, going to give a medical diagnosis, but seemed to have some deranged thought processes. And there was an element of he's blaming Governor Walz and that kind of thing. So sure, no, he could traumatize. I mean, he could traumatize the community again. He certainly could traumatize the families with what he has to say. We'll see if he says it. It's just as that reporter in me, I kind of wanted.
I want
a little bit more beyond the detail, just an explanation, like what finally set him off. We heard about the planning. We heard about the use of the internet, the GPS devices, the stalking, the doing his research. Like, he knew names, he knew home layouts, he knew addresses. You know, he went to the two lawmakers in between. I mean, that night. I mean, we've talked about, I mean, it's been a year now, but, you know, the fact that, you know, I know law enforcement gets questioned about what happened, how he got away for the 43 hours he did, but if they don't intercept his vehicle at the home of the Hortmans and the arsenal he had there and the research he had done, it could have been a whole lot more bloodshed that weekend a year ago now.
Paul Bloom, Fox 9, was in the courtroom today. You know, we talked a little bit about the lack of emotion from Vance Belter. I imagine, this had to be so hard for the families to sit there and face him. Was there emotion from them, or were they stoic?
I thought my best view was of John Hoffman, just the way the gallery works. His wife, Yvette, was on the other side of him, so I didn't get a good facial view of her. And the Hortmans were all sort of mixed together among supporters in the back. As I mentioned, you know, the assassination, the details in the Hortman house really drew what I would describe as the loudest and most overwhelming emotion.
We just didn't know that. Yeah. We didn't know. I mean, the details of sort of just how just horrific and manipulative with Mark Hortman. And then chasing Melissa essentially up the stairs and putting a gun to her head. I mean, just crushing to get those details.
Yeah. And you know, we go to these allocutions and, you know, sometimes they're a little bit more antiseptic. There's, you know, did you use a gun? Did you do X? You know, you're kind of just establishing the sort of the letter of the law. Like, you have to admit to each and every sort of, subdivision to sort of admit to the crime, and the court can then find you guilty of the crime. But yeah, those details, were shocking. Like, you know, I've covered this case as close as anyone for the last year. I had not heard those. And, the manipulation at the door, and like that he knows, you know, she's likely in the house. He kind of concocts a story that there's been a shooting nearby. I'm here to check on it. Who else is at home? You know, he's at the door with Mark Cortman, the husband, and he admits to sort of asking who else is in the home. And he's like, oh, just my wife. She's upstairs sleeping. And then he's pretending to be a Maple Grove police officer. He says, well, I'll just need to see, you know, check on her to make sure she's okay before I leave. So, like, that's what beckons Melissa sort of down the stairs to come into this horrifying exchange. And then, yeah, he chases her down and assassinates her on her own stairs as she's trying to get away. And, I mean, just horrific, horrific details. And, you know, this does avoid a trial, right? I don't know. You know, I know people have some different, you know, opinions on this. Certainly followed social media, your listeners and others, our viewers, having mixed feelings, you know, the death penalty being taken off the table. Like, if this isn't the crime that warrants a death penalty, what does? You know, politically motivated, he admitted he was going after lawmakers. Obviously, the U.S. attorney made that decision to not pursue the death penalty, but to take the sort of, you know, done deal. We get him. We have two life sentences plus 20 years on top of that. He's not going anywhere. He'll never take a breath of freedom again. That was enough for the federal government to take the death penalty off the table.
And you also wonder about, like, let's also be realistic in knowing that the victims in this case are Minnesota Democrats who in a state that doesn't have the death penalty. So as much as like I might have my own beliefs about what I think should happen, I think it's also fair to take a beat and acknowledge that I bet the victims' families have a divergence of opinion, or at least a number of opinions in that group as to what they think should happen.
Yeah, we know they were consulted, and by statute, certainly the family of the Hortmans is sort of, they're the victims of the death penalty crime because they were killed. But I know, you know, the Hoffmans also met with the U.S. attorney, and Daniel Rosen certainly listened to them. There is a taking of opinion. My understanding from folks close to the victims' families was there was a divergent mix. You know, there were differing opinions on whether they wanted a death penalty sought. And, you know, with somebody telling me they actually thought or has been on record that Melissa was against the death penalty, I certainly am not. I don't cover the Capitol well enough to know her exact position. And if I'm misstating it, I do apologize. But that there were some mixed feelings on that. But most notably, the one thing that I think controlled the possibility of pursuing capital punishment in this specific case was the legalities of it, right? Yeah. You mentioned Minnesota doesn't have it in state statute. So it had to be a federal offense, and the feds have to find an offense in which it fits to get a death penalty case. And what they've done is this sort of combination of murder and an interstate stalking, meaning you use the internet or GPS devices to stalk and then you kill. But in Luigi Mangione's case in New York City, where he jumps out in the dark and he attacks the UnitedHealthcare, you know, CEO and kills Brian Thompson, that charge was thrown out as a capital punishment charge in New York. And while not precedential in Minnesota, there was some thought that because it was similarly charged here in Minnesota, the stalking, the murder, that it might be hard to get that charge accepted as a death penalty charge through our district court. U.S. attorney says the circumstances are different enough. What happened in the Hortman home was as violent a stalk as you can get, as opposed to Thompson, where he kind of jumps out of the dark. There's no sort of fear created. It happens in seconds. It's done. It's over, as opposed to what took place in the Hortman home. They thought they could fight it, but they also could see it taking years and going up to the appeals court and the Supreme Court and decisions coming back and forth. And maybe it takes half a dozen years and we end up right where we did today. Why not just take sort of, you know, what you have in hand? He's willing to take the two life sentences. He's willing to accept a life behind bars.
And shut it.
Attorney Mike Bryant joined DeRussia to talk about the case this week as well.
Well, it obviously is, you know, for me, it brings back this guilty plea does bring back all of the emotions of that day almost a year ago. It is a heavy day for those who work in politics and for those who love this state. It is a reminder of just that horrific 48 hours and that horrific moment in our history.
Yeah, and Dan, for peace, I knew Melissa real well, and it just, yeah, it's a horrible thing to have something like that happen, and still really no understanding of why.
Yeah, I think that's the most frustrating thing when you have a plea deal and you don't have a full trial. Of course, I've covered plenty of trials. You've been an attorney in plenty of trials where you have a full trial and you still are not left with any real understanding of the truth as to what motivates people, right?
Right, correct, yeah. And, you know, that's the – but, I mean, I don't know if there'd be any answer. Anybody would go, well, yeah, that makes sense.
Right,
but,
yeah.
You know, it's still a crazy thing. And I don't know. It's a sad – another sad example of, you know, some of the things that are going on in the world.
Let's talk a little bit about why there is – sort of two trials. There's this federal trial that we had. Why in a case like this can somebody be charged federally and also face to an outsider what feels like the same bit on the state level?
Because there's different claims that are being made or different crimes that are being committed. There's a federal crime with the terroristic act or the political act that took place. And originally the thought was the feds got involved. And what happens when the feds get involved, they can preempt, which means they can take it over. And that comes into play. And so they got involved. And originally it was thought they got involved because there was going to be a death penalty part to that.
Right,
because
right.
We don't have the death penalty in the state, and they were able to do that federally. Then a deal got made, and the deal basically was no death penalty in return for the sentence for life. And because of that, you know, it made sense for the defendant because he was facing the death penalty. Then the question came up, why are the feds involved? And there's a conspiracy side to it that they were trying to control the narrative so that it didn't look political as it could have. There's also the outside discussion out there of whether or not he could then be pardoned because it's a federal crime. A president can pardon a federal crime where the governor can only pardon a state crime. I couldn't even comprehend that as a possibility with what took place in this case. So
I'm with you. I mean, I understand the conspiracy side of that. And look, let's be real. With the federal government right now, almost there's no such thing as inconceivable. But to me, that is like, that seems like people looking a little too hard to put the tinfoil hat on.
Yeah. It seems I couldn't comprehend the thought of a pardon there. But I don't think he has any kind of ties that would indicate something like that, where, you know, there's been people who've kind of bought their pardons over history, you know, as far as what's taken place there. But it's it does make you question why the feds got involved if they weren't going to just say, no, we're going to go for the death penalty no matter what. But they are. Now, it kind of makes the state case unimportant. The state can do a couple of things. One, the state can just kind of accept that the feds are taking it over and just let them have it. They could continue on just so they can get the conviction in state court, just to basically have a conviction. Then if something did happen, you know, it's kind of the reverse of what happened with Chauvin, where he was convicted in state court, and then they convicted him in federal court, and they went ahead and executed the federal court part of it, so he's in a federal prison. But the state sentence is still out there, so that if something did happen or there was some weird thing that happened that he was pardoned or something happened with the federal charge, you'd still have the state charges there to keep him in prison for the rest of his life. So he's in prison for the rest of his life. I don't see that that'll ever change. He can, you know, try to do some way off into the future, but I don't think that'll change as far as what the facts go.
Mike Bryant is with us, Bradshaw and Bryant, a criminal defense attorney. Mike, when you look at, you know, when you look at the state prosecution now, if you're Vance Belter, why wouldn't you take a plea deal at the state level? At this point, what's the difference? Unless you wanted to have the platform of getting on the stand and, you know, going through whatever was in his supposed manifesto.
Yeah, and that's a possibility that he may decide that no. Although the reality is, with the sentence he's already got in federal prison with the life, it's unexpected. There'll probably just be a sentencing and a plea and a sentencing, and there'll be not much else as far as the state goes. But it's possible he has a right to do that. And if he does, then you might have him wanting to take the stand to make some statement one way or the other.
In this case, the federal officials, there was some conflicting reporting over the last couple of days as to whether this case would have qualified for the death penalty. The U.S. attorney today said, no, I think, if we got a guilty, if we went to trial and got a guilty verdict, that he thinks it still might be death penalty eligible. At a certain point, I guess you have to weigh, and in all of these cases, you're weighing, is it worth putting the families through all of this stuff when you can at least say, look, this guy's going to be locked up forever?
Yeah. The death penalty is a tough thing for lots of people. A lot of people are opposed to it overall.
And we don't know what the victims' families in this case, we don't know where they were on this, right?
Yeah. And so based upon that, that you're right. I mean, you save the family having to go through it. You get the sentencing and he ends up going to prison. I've seen some people complain about the 40 years, but I mean, it's his life. He's going to be in there for life. And it's not, I don't think that's a concern as far as it goes. It's just a number that's being used to facilitate that.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to KRLD 1080 in Dallas and WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, real people tell their stories live on stage.
I burst into tears. And I wasn't sure if I was crying because I hadn't been kissed in a really long time or if I had just never been kissed like that before.
To hear fascinating, heartbreaking, and sometimes hilarious stories from astronauts, teachers, farmers, and people just like you, follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.